listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Chris Mueller is a national speaker, author, father of six, and is currently making a Catholic TV show for families as he travels speaking to over 10,000 people each year. Between Chris having over 18 years experience in Catholic lay ministry and Timmery's holding a master's degree in biblical theology, together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
Hey friends, Timmery here. Chris is out traveling, educating and activating and growing in faith with many teens across the country. This week, it is just I, and I have some incredible questions from you guys, especially later on in the show, questions about how to handle family members who are experiencing same-sex attraction, how to handle that desire to post something on social media that you want someone specific to see, but you're worried about how it will be received. All of these questions, these hesitations, and even the confusion, we're going to be talking really solidly later in the show of what is sex for? What is the church's teaching on marriage and procreation? And especially, you know, how do we look at this in light of the current, I think, push of this idea? Well, love wins, right? We hear this in the world right now, especially surrounding the same-sex attraction area. And we're seeing a lot of reduction of the person to their sexual desires rather than seeing them as a person. And I hope that we're able to work through this together and help you in answering some of those questions. First up, though, it has been really fascinating. Over the last couple weeks, I've been looking at this study from the Archives of Sexual Behavior. It is a journal. And I heard that basically today's millennials are two times more likely to be sexually inactive as Gen X. So essentially, those in their 20s now are less sexually active than the previous generations. We're seeing that 20-year-olds are having less sex than ever before. Pretty fascinating when you think about it, going back, let's say, to the 60s, to the 70s and 80s, all the way to today. We live in this culture where while fewer people are married, fewer people are having children, well, fewer people are also having sex, despite the quote-unquote benefits, right, of protected sex, of that fail-safe with abortion, right? And again, we could get into all of the conversation about contraception, abortion, the destruction of human life, the damage done to that woman and man who have had and conceived this child, the chemical impact of hormonal contraception on a woman's body. But I want to get into a little bit deeper of this. You know, we're seeing that as people are essentially are two times less likely to be sexually inactive, to be sexually active than the generations before. Why is that? And I'm hearing in a lot of the conversation surrounding men, that men say they're at the point where they're lacking courage almost to approach that woman. And I'm just talking about conversations, not even going into what applies after. And we're not talking about chastity right now specifically, but the fact that as a culture, we're interacting less in what continues the procreation, essentially leads to the growing of the human species, right? And I think that that becomes problematic as we're seeing the decline in how many children are being born today. And the fact that places like Toys R Us are closing. You know, I was looking at this from the man's perspective, and they're saying, you know, women often give this message that they're not needed, that then the man lacks courage because, well, she doesn't need me. And also, if she thinks I'm unnecessary, well, she probably doesn't want me to speak to her to begin with. And, you know, in light of today, I hear a lot of my friends who are in their mid-30s who are single, and they're sitting here saying, you know, I look back and realize I kind of wasn't interested in dating. I was focused on other things. And I see how maybe that shut down some of the opportunity to just date a couple people, not even committing to marriage. You know, that first date, we have to remember, we're just getting to know each other. You're on a recon mission. You're getting to know each other, gathering the right information, and, you know, not overcommitting too soon. We've talked a lot about, you know, some of the art of dating in that new documentary that came out. Did any of you guys see it? It's basically looking at The Dating Project is what it's called, and how we can be better at, you know, not giving too much of ourselves right away, even in the dates, but maybe pre-planning. It's only going to be 30 to 45 minutes. We meet for coffee or we meet for ice cream, because maybe sitting down for a whole meal is actually too much. And you're just trying to gather information in that first date. You know, is this someone I'm interested in developing a deeper relationship with? Well, if no one's willing to even ask those questions for that simple ice cream or coffee, well, we're getting to the point where it's no surprise that while people are willing to just hop into bed together, they're also less willing to have sex. I heard one guy put it this way. He was talking about how basically, why would I try to approach that woman when I basically have the opportunity to win at home by sitting here looking at pornography? And, you know, we've gotten to the point where men feel more courageous, more active, more part of a participant being at home looking at pornography. And I think that there's also a problem with women. Not only are so women, you know, ladies, we're at the point where we love to live on social media. And while in one sense it can be a distraction, on the other sense it can be great for helping us get to know people, stay connected. But I think a lot of the time we're not willing to either go out on that date or go out and interact with people, even friendships. I'm not even just talking about male, female, potential spouses here, but I'm talking about especially friends too. Are we maybe not willing to be that person's friend because we checked out all of their past social media posts? We saw their political stance on this specific candidate. We saw them smearing or disagreeing with something that really we are passionate about. You know, we judge people online before we have the opportunity to see them face to face. And not only is that happening in our friendships, but one-on-one. I know I've tried to be better. And again, there are times where you really just need to know a little bit about that person before you meet up with them in person, whether professionally or friendships at a party. Maybe you're trying to remember someone's name. I'm a great person with faces. Names, that can be challenging. But, you know, maybe giving the opportunity to meet them face to face, ask questions, get involved before you hop onto social media, because then we're just making assumptions. And, you know, coming back to this whole idea that millennials are two times more likely to be sexually inactive than Gen X, and even more so than the generations prior to them, I think that allowing for that environment of conversation, allowing for that environment of getting to know each other offline is important. Using social media is a great opportunity for staying in contact, but it's not necessarily a great way to get to know a person, because you hear their extremes usually, their extreme emotions, their extreme passions for moral ideologies and so forth. And you also only see the good moments on social media too, whether it's that family vacation that they took or where they're traveling for work at that given day. And so offering that opportunity to get to know each other away from social media, offering that opportunity for maybe you leave yourself available for someone to approach you, to ask you on a date, or even just to get to know your name. I think that's important too before asking someone out as well. And sometimes we're avoiding eye contact. I know that this is one of those things I can be terrible about. I was actually just on my way into the studio today. I was walking into the bathroom and I looked at someone and said, "Hi, how are you?" And they looked up startled from their internal thought. And man, it's a reminder for us that we sometimes really do lack that interaction on a basic social level, yet we're willing to text a person on the other side of the country saying, "Hey, I'm thinking about you," when we're forgetting about the people right in front of us. There are so many opportunities just to say hello, reach out. I was just at church the other day and this young man reached out to me and a friend of mine, and he said, "Hey, I see you at the gym every day. My name's so-and-so," and they're getting to know each other, chatting, and you know, they have this opportunity to say, "Hey, now I'm going to say hello at the gym when I see you, and maybe this is a potential friend to have." And I think today there's this tendency to go, "Oh, I see you at the gym almost every morning, 5 a.m. in the morning. I see you. I know I've seen you at mass, but I'm not going to say hello." And it really stood out to me that this man stepped up and said hello to my friend, and how rare that is. And this guy instantly had my respect. And I think it's because a lot of us lack social courage on a day-to-day basis to get uncomfortable, or maybe to even disrupt our own contemplation at the moment, or the internal dialogue that other people are having. And I think that we could use more of those opportunities to say hello. You know, living in Southern California, I feel like we're so apt to just pass by, keep our eye on the prize, whether you're hiking or whatever it is. But growing up in a small town, we used to always say hello to the person on the trail next to us. Maybe take a minute to comment that, hey, there's a big stream up ahead. It's going to be a little difficult to cross. Versus I've noticed down in San Diego where I live now, if I'm hiking and I warn someone about something on the trail, you know, they'll kind of act either one of two things. They're shocked that you said something and they kind of have this attitude, well, I can figure it out on my own. Or they have this response of, oh, wow, thank you. That was really nice of you. Why is it that we have the two extremes? And, you know, we think about the fact that God calls us to be a light to the world. Well, in the midst of a time where people are having less sex, fewer children, fewer dates, I think the opportunity to just reach out and have those simple conversations can really change the dynamic of how lonely and fearful people can be today. It gives us the opportunity to break into that internal dialogue that I know for so many people can be really challenging day in and day out, especially for someone who maybe struggles with loneliness, anxiety, or depression. We're made for human contact, and that human contact makes a really big influence on our general well-being. So this is Timory Millington. You are listening to Trending. We're going to be talking a little bit more coming up, especially about same-sex attraction and how the church responds. I know a lot of people get uncomfortable. They're worried about how to approach this. They don't want to offend people. They want people to feel welcome. And I'll be the first to admit, I think some of the education and reaching out we hear about same-sex attraction isn't always very helpful or welcoming, or it's outright confusing. So we'll be talking about that a little bit more coming up on Trending.
Chris and Timory will be right back. Tweet them at C Mueller Tweets, spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R, and at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Chris Mueller is out this week, but Timory is here. It's good to be with you guys. I had a listener write to me, actually two of you specifically this week, write to me about the topic of same-sex marriage, same-sex attraction. You guys have really reached out saying, you know, I'm struggling with this. So Sarah, you sent me this video specifically where it's talking about how basically, being gay is a gift from God. Now, this is a tough topic because you hear the LGBTQ rights movement really kind of pushing this idea, especially those who are coming from a Christian perspective and they're trying to bring their faith into their lifestyle, essentially. And wouldn't we love to do that? Everything we do, say, this is a gift from God. Whether it's our desire to eat a ton of candy and to the point of overconsumption, the desire to whatever it might be, these bad examples or good examples, but maybe taking something in excess, that we would always like to invite God into our lives. And so I see what the LGBTQ movement is trying to do is they're trying to say, I actually want to reconcile my faith with my lifestyle. But what happens is sometimes we begin to justify things. Well, one of the things, dear listeners, that I have seen is that people try in justifying this type of lifestyle, they like to just point fingers and blame the church. People will get upset and say, well, this is a really great example. This week, I was listening to a YouTube video that was done during Pride Month, right, this month. And it was talking about opening up this conversation by saying this. There was a young little boy and he was someone who had same-sex attraction and, you know, he was gay. And basically the teacher told him that he was disordered, needed to be fixed, and really pushed on him conversion therapy. This is how the talk is introduced. And the pastor, who I believe he is actually gay, ends up saying, actually, this is not something that happens in our schools. It's not something that happens at all in our schools. And he said, but this is what the church does. And my heart broke for a moment there, hearing this man say, this example, making it sound like it was something that happened every day when it doesn't happen in our schools. I'm glad he said that. But he went and pointed the finger at the church, and the church is the reason people have regrets. The church is the reason people hate themselves. And we've got to come back to a fuller conversation of what sexuality is. You know, people are saying that religion has destroyed countless gay lives because they've said things such as the word disordered or needing to be fixed. But in fact, if you look at what the Catholic Church has to say, nowhere does it say that you need to be fixed. Nowhere does it say that you need to do therapy to remove your same-sex attraction. What it does say is that homosexual acts, so the physical act of a man and a man or a woman and a woman, is intrinsically disordered, that sexual act. Why is the church saying that? Because ultimately, the way our bodies fit together and work, the only possible way to bring about a means to an end of the end being a child is through male and female anatomy. Now, we're going to get into the argument for this a little bit, both biblically and from the theological perspective, and really looking at human anthropology. Where have we come from looking at anthropology in the light of the human person, our development, with the light of faith? Because we can answer these questions. And so when the church throws out these certain words where you hear intrinsically disordered, they're not saying a person is. They're saying the specific act. And there's a big difference. That's why, for example, you know, Sarah, you wrote to me this week and you said, hey, it's hard for me as a good faithful, and you added heterosexual Catholic, you know, to not be confused, essentially, when I'm looking at what some people are saying in the church. You said, you know, I've seen people saying, well, oh, it's okay to get married as long as you're not married within the Catholic Church with someone of the same sex. Well, the answer or the question is, what is marriage, right? And we're going to get to that. Or where people say, well, I'm hearing one thing in the media about what Pope Francis has said. And you may remember it was about 4 years ago, Pope Francis was talking about the gay issue, and he said, who am I to judge? He wasn't talking about, he's basically using this phrase, instead of saying love the sinner, hate the sin, he's saying, you know, we're not meant to just judge a person. We can look at their actions, but, you know, this idea of pulling back and seeing the person at the heart of the conversation. And so I really love when we look at that. It's another way of saying, oh, not only who am I to judge, but let's love the sinner, love the person, right? Because their sin does not define them, although it is a roadblock that can prevent them from that full union with God. And we're going to look at this biblically coming up and what the New Testament offers in terms of the life of God. So one of the things that I've heard a lot of people asking me, and one of my friends was just asking the other day, she said, man, I feel like I'm having a hard time with my family. You know, my parents come from a really traditional view of Catholicism, and I'm all on board about my faith. But we've had family members who are experiencing same-sex attraction, and basically the family panics. You guys, I've seen these situations over and over again. Whether it's a niece, nephew, cousin, sibling, they think, oh no, like, can we invite them over for dinner still? What topics can we talk about? We've got to stop. Hold up for a second. This is where it's so helpful, this saying, love the sinner, not the sin. Who am I to judge and say you are not welcome here, right? Who? That's not our job. We have a great judge in heaven, and you and I are not him, right? Man, I would not want that job. I mean, just imagine, I would not want that job. Our responsibility is to remember that we have a responsibility to love, to reach out, to be with other people. And this gets into the conversation of Evangelium Vitae, which we have this great document from John Paul II. And it's where John Paul II is basically looking and evaluating, well, let's start with our human anthropology. Let's go to the beginning of the Bible. We have Adam and Eve, and we see the fall of Adam and Eve. And not long after that, we see the first examples of worship, right? Or you see Cain and Abel, and Abel's there offering this great sacrifice of his very first of everything he has to God, his first fruits, essentially, right? Recognizing that everything I have is a gift from you, so I'm going to give you my best and then take everything else from there. It's an example of prayer. Maybe God giving God our best in the first moments of our morning, of pausing in prayer before we do anything else, going, you come first in my life, in my time, in my material needs, right? In the material that I myself have. Well, what happens is Cain kills Abel, right? Right after Cain kills Abel, what happens? Basically, Cain is conversing with God, and God is asking Cain, where is your brother Abel? Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? Just think about that. Am I responsible for my brother? The answer is, if we look at this from the church perspective, yes, we are our brother's keeper. This enters into so much of what we have in the tradition of the church. You know, we look at the sixth commandment, right? You shall not commit adultery. And Jesus expands upon this, and he's saying, not only shall you not commit adultery, but you shall not even lust after that person. He's not saying that the fact you have that desire is a bad thing. He's saying, don't indulge it, right? Don't give in to your desire in this moment. And this enters into the first two commandments, right? Love of God and love of neighbor. If we're going to love our neighbor, we're going to see that we have a responsibility for them. We have a responsibility to care for them, to want what is best for them. And I think this idea that, oh, well, I don't invite that person who's experiencing same-sex attraction into my home. You can't invite someone into your home, but you can also expect a certain level of conduct within your home. Maybe you have young children, and maybe, you know, you invite both them and their partner into your home. And maybe, you know, there's a little too much physical contact taking place. You can just say, hey, just try and make sure we don't have physical contact in front of the kids right now. Or just say, hey, you know, if that arises. But the reality is, I think that people know that when you're reaching out and welcoming them in and you're making an effort, they too are going to make an effort. And I think that sharing that common meal that is so biblical provides that opportunity to raise the bar of expectations for one another and not exclude each other. You know, I had someone really get mad at me last summer saying, so you're telling me that I need to invite this person. And I looked back at them and said, Jesus is the almighty judge, right? He has the ability to forgive sins. And he talks about adultery. He talks about having even higher expectations for us than in the Old Testament. Not only shall you not commit adultery, you shall not even desire, give in to your desires. They're there, they're present, but you shall not give in to it. And he, at the same time, is raising the bar even higher. At the same time, he also pulled back and he ate with tax collectors and sinners. Mary Magdalene, a woman who came from great sin and was transformed by the grace of God, is a fantastic example of this. And, you know, I look at what the church says in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and it talks a lot about, for all of us facing our darkness, our sin, it says Jesus came to restore creation to the purity of its origins. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I look at that and I look at, what am I struggling with? What are my disordered desires? Because all of us have them. And how am I called to be a new creation in Christ and conquer and walk through the drudgery and the darkness that all of us face in our own ways? This is something more we're going to be talking about, especially a scriptural perspective on the issue of same-sex attraction.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.
Hi, I'm Chris Mueller.
And I'm Timory Millington.
Hey, on Trending, we discuss today's most relevant topics from sex to social media.
These aren't topics that are awkward or uncomfortable at all to bring up with family and friends.
We're called to be a light in the world and challenge modern ideologies for the kingdom of God and for eternal salvation.
That can feel discouraging sometimes, but here on Trending, we try to help equip you to know what's going on in the world and bring our faith into the conversation.
Hey, so listen Sundays on Relevant Radio, or you can find episodes of Trending with Chris and Timory podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app.
You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Chris Mueller is out this week. Timory Millington here. It's great to be with you guys. I'm answering Colleen and Sarah. You guys have written in with some questions about the gay issue. And confusion, saying, you know, I want to follow what the church is teaching, but I'm also getting a little confused with some of the messages I'm seeing in the media. And I want to put this forward. You know, we talked about this earlier in the show, if you're just joining us, I want to throw it out there. You guys go to timmery.com and pull up the podcast of this show. We're actually getting ready to launch the new website very quickly here. It's almost done. But you can pull up and list a link to this show. And we're going to be talking in the full episode for the most part about how do we approach the topic of gay marriage and conversation, and especially what does the church teach and how do we respond to it? So looking at this, we've got to come from the perspective of being our brother's keeper. You know, God looks down at Cain after Cain has killed Abel, and he's going, where's your brother? And he's giving Cain the opportunity to say, I did something to him, right? I killed him. In this act of jealousy, in this act of rage, I killed him. He's giving really that first opportunity for Cain to have that moment of confession, that reconciliation with God, that complete honesty before God. God knows, but he's looking down at Cain going, tell me, share with me. And instead, Cain's response is, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer is yes. If we look at the church's documents, especially looking at the church on this idea of love, right? And this idea of freedom. You know, we talk a lot in the church about the dignity of the human person. What does that mean? That means that we, as created in God's image and likeness, we are also made for love. Because you guys, you know, I hate that expression when you hear people say, God is love. Oh gosh, that sounds so mushy sometimes, right? But we hear God is love, and then we hear that we're made in God's image and likeness. And I swear, some people say that in the church trying to make us feel good. It's like, oh, you're made in God's image and likeness. Here, you're feeling down. You're thinking, oh, that really doesn't make me feel better. Or maybe it does, but it can seem somewhat abstract. Well, if God is love and we are made in his image and likeness, well, what that means is that we are made for love. And with that, that means that there's something in us that is like God. Well, if we're made for love, think about that for a moment. If we're made for love, we have to be able to freely choose it. Because otherwise, if we just perfectly obeyed every one of God's commandments and we're like robots, right, following the Ten Commandments, well, then that would be slavery, right? If we were forced to do it against our will. So free will is an important part of the dignity of the human person. But so is intellect. Because not only should we be able to freely choose love, but we should be able to come to it reasonably, right? We should be able to come to know something. There are two parts of the brain. I love when I do presentations about pornography and helping young people or even parents working with their young people in the home and how to fight that issue of pornography, that there are two parts to our brain, right? The feeling brain and the thinking brain. And at the thinking brain, it's pretty cool, you guys, looking at neuroscience and just science overall, that the thinking brain is like a little cap that comes over the front of the feeling brain. And it's in your prefrontal cortex that you really have that conversation of intellect and reason over the passions that are burning within us, revving up like a car engine, ready to go and run that race, right? This is the same thing with our attraction. And that's why we've got to recognize that while freedom is a wonderful thing, freedom is love in the truest sense, because this is what it is, you guys. It's solidarity with the people around us. It's that moment where we choose on the cross, where Jesus chose to put himself on the cross. Those moments, those precious moments where he placed himself on the cross in solidarity with us and said, I choose you. He chose love in the midst of all of our transgressions, right? In the midst of all of our sin, he goes, I choose you, and I'm going to blot it out if you will only come to me. And this is where you have people saying, well, I'm coming out because this is my truth and this is what I know. But if God is the light of the world, he comes to enter into the darkness. He comes to shatter what we believe is our truth and to bring to light what is true truth, what is real. And I think that when we look at the biblical conversation of this, we're able to look at this a little bit more. We've got to start by looking at the question of what is marriage? Every sexual act within marriage is meant to be unitive and procreative, right? So marriage is the solidarity between a man and woman coming together. In the end, the primary end of marriage is children, right? If we look at this, the primary end of marriage is children. That makes sense, right? His body and her body can fit together. Well, when we look at the church's teaching on sexuality, what is required is that every sexual act has two elements. It is meant to be unitive for the good of the spouses, both from a pleasure perspective and for the growth of the two together. It's meant to unite them. But the second requirement for every sexual act is that that sexual act is procreative, which means it's open to life. This is why things such as hormonal contraception, right, is not being open to life within the sexual act. And the church is saying you don't have to have children every time you have sex. In fact, you don't have the ability to have a child every time you have sex, right? But God is asking you as a church to be open to the other person, just like Christ was on those moments on the cross, to be open to sharing a life with your partner and jumping full into that life with your partner into the creation of the human person. And so what it's saying is, because the end of marriage is procreation, the primary end of marriage is children, we're going to create an environment where these two people are committed to each other for life and raising and rearing this child physically, emotionally, spiritually. That's what marriage is made for. Marriage is made for the good of the spouses and for the procreation and education of children. That's the summary of what the church teaches. Let's just look at this for a moment. So sex is a good thing within marriage, but it's not the end of marriage itself. Sex is meant to unite us and to make it so that we can have children. So this is where we have to flip the conversation. We have in our modern view that sex is love, but in fact, love enters into opening for a greater opportunity to get to know each other. And one of those developments in the sexual act is it is an act of love. You know, we no longer talk today, when you think about it, about making love. We say, oh, having sex or hooking up, when in reality, it's a total gift of self. It's a uniting of the two people. It is the ability, the potential. You guys, there's something powerful about the fact that a whole new human being can come from that act. And, you know, we hear this conversation too, that one of the main responsibilities of marriage is to get your spouse to heaven, and how fundamental that is. Through sickness, through trial, maybe that other person has a big vice that they are struggling through, that there's this fidelity there in that marriage to help get your spouse to heaven. We get this idea from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 14, where we read about whether it's the husband or the wife having a spouse who's not a believer, who does not follow Christ, and how through the faithful spouse's witness, through their selfless and sacrificial love, they're actually sanctifying that spouse. And hopefully by the grace of God, right, in the intercession of their spouse, they will convert. But how there's actually a huge burden placed, and I could say burden, but we should look about at it as a responsibility. That responsibility that even if that spouse isn't Catholic, right, even if that spouse isn't even any form of Christianity, right, that you have that responsibility to sanctify them through your love, through your humility, through your sacrifices, through the modesty you exhibit, through that self-mastery. And so when we're talking about the issue of whether it's two heterosexual individuals, right, who are dating and they're really attracted to one another and want to engage in the sexual act, or maybe it's two people of the same sex who are struggling, we have to look at what the church is saying. And the church is sitting here offering us the opportunity to life-giving, self-giving love. And it's saying, well, if you're not engaged within the confines of marriage, you can't participate in the sexual act because it's meant to be unitive and it's meant to be procreative. This is where we also get the idea of marriage being total. It's a total gift of self. It's faithful. So there's that fidelity, right? It's permanent and it's fruitful. I don't know about you guys, but isn't this what we all desire? A love that is permanent, that is faithful to one another, that is fruitful, that grows and goes out, and it's freely chosen. You know, choosing love and choosing to recognize that there are some sacrifices along the way that have to be made is important. And so when people say love wins, love is meant to win. Love will conquer all. But am I creating my own version of what love is, right? Am I creating my own ideas? Just like, you know, the issue here is that for some reason we think that self-mastery isn't something that's necessary in the Christian lifestyle. But it is. The catechism of that Catholic Church actually really places emphasis for all people, especially for single people, though, to use that opportunity for self-mastery and at times to grow in what we'd call disinterested friendship. So that's friendship where I care about you, but I'm not just seeking what my own sexual desires are or my emotional desires are. Yes, there's a reciprocity in the friendship, but we're working to receive and love that person and give to that person without just expecting this quid pro quo, I scratch your back, you scratch my back type of mentality. And I think if we can spin that on its head, reach out more so, have that opportunity to grow in these types of relationships and self-mastery, self-control, we'd be living more of what Jesus says is not only shall you not commit adultery, but you shall not even lust after that person. God's saying, you may have that desire, that may arise, but you're offered the opportunity for self-mastery, for disinterested friendship. And so as we're talking more about this in this last segment here, we're going to be talking about some of the scriptural references having to do with same-sex attraction, especially in the New Testament, ensuring that this still agrees with the Old Testament and what was said. And we're also going to answer a couple of those last questions that I'm hearing about the issue of same-sex attraction and how to reach out to our brothers and sisters in faith and in love.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Chris and Timmery.
Chris is out this week. You have Timmery Millington here. I'm excited to be with all of you. So we are talking on the show, if you're just joining us, about same-sex attraction, looking at what is marriage, what does the church have to say, why does the church have this language that feels so harsh, the words are disordered, right? You always hear this come up. What is the church saying? It's talking about the act of being disordered, never the person. And it's, you know, we talked earlier in the show, but about inviting those people in to have meals with us, whether it's family members and friends. Of course, having a high level of expectation of them, you know, a certain level of conduct. And the reality is when you reach out on a limb, when you go out and you're willing to have some common ground of a human experience, such as a meal, they're going to rise to the occasion for the most part. And it's when they're not willing to rise to the occasion, when they're actually not respecting you in person, that's when we have issues. And I think because we're on social media so much, we're so polarizing on the topic, it makes it hard to even be willing to have those invitations take place. Because just like at the beginning of the show, we're talking about the fact that, you know, millennials are two times more likely not to have sexual interaction as those in their 20s for Gen X and boomers and so forth. That's saying something, and I think that enters into this question of social media and how we assume because how people respond on social media, because people can be so polarizing and quick to talk about the tough topics, we assume that that's what'll happen when we invite someone over to dinner. But the reality is that's not. First of all, we can always be so awkward and we talk about the weather first, right? Talk about your kids and what they're doing right now. You talk about that trip you have coming up. We talk about the good stuff. We talk about the common experiences. Usually these tough topics don't come up right away. So I want to talk before we close the show up today just a little bit about the perspective of sacred scripture. If we were to look at the book of Romans, right, St. Paul's letter to the Romans in the New Testament, we would look at the theme of it and then look at the text. So in Romans chapter 1, there's this conversation where it actually outright points to unnatural relations and how men and women become consumed for one another and do shameless acts and receive due penalty. We hear about, you know, people who lie, people who steal, and all of these immoral actions are clumped into one thing. Well, let's take a rewind second, because here we just saw that Romans chapter 1 touches on the topic of homosexuality, clearly making it a sin, right? Continuing to live with the teaching of Leviticus, where we see references to this as well. And it's peppered all throughout sacred scripture. Well, in Romans, if we look at the overarching theme of Romans, the theme of Romans is this idea of God's grace actually having salvific power. And this is what's so powerful about St. Paul. St. Paul, who came from a life of sin. You guys, a life of killing Christians. A life, we may look, and there are so many elements. You know, he even talks about how, you know, I want to do one thing, but my body, my desires are taking over and going in a different direction, right? And you hear in his letters, a progression of his letters, and how you get to 1st and 2nd Timothy toward the end of his life. And he talks about, I fought the fight. I finished the race. You know, he's about to win that prize to the onward call to be with God. His story is a story of grace to salvation, of sin working, grace coming in and radically changing his life. of dying and rising with Christ, this death to self and this life in the Spirit. So if this is what Romans is talking about, if this is what St. Paul is saying in the letters to the Romans, and he's pointing to sexual immorality, all types of ethical issues, he's saying what's happened here, and we read about this, he said, we've, as a population, as a people, have exchanged the glory of God for mortal men, for animals. He talks about how we've exchanged that glory to be essentially like reptiles. Think about this, guys. We've allowed our lower sexual organs to rule over our minds, right? Our idea of self-mastery, self-discipline, this disinterested friendship where we're not just looking for what we can get out of it, but what we can give to that other person. So we see St. Paul talking about how not only have we exchanged the glory of God for mortal man and being like reptiles and animals, but we've also exchanged it for a lie. And we're taking on this truth that we think is truth. You guys, is this not the crisis and the dilemma of today? What St. Paul was talking about to the early church can be ever relevant to us in our modern conversation and struggle. And he talks about how basically God is calling us to this life of grace. God is calling us to be faithful, and God is calling us to die to self. So that context all of a sudden puts into perspective that we're not just talking about this desire in the moment, but we're talking about the end goal, the eschatological purpose. And that's a big word, but if we think about the eschatos, that means the end times, right? And so St. Paul is saying, look at the big picture. We are trying to be taken from sin and bondage into eternal life. Something has to change. If God is perfect order, if God is truth, if God made the bodies male and female, and he put Adam and Eve in the garden in a perfect state of justice, in a perfect state of unity, in a state of nakedness. You know, if we think about this original justice, Adam and Eve understood each other. That original state of justice, because the worship toward God was clear, this vertical relationship from man to God was clear, the horizontal relationships with friends and family members and intimate others, that was clear as well. But just like in Romans, we read, we've given up the glory of God. We've exchanged worship of the creator for the worship of the creature. Well, what has happened there? We've now exchanged that original sense of justice, right? The original sense of the spousal meaning of the body. We've given that up. We've become self-worshippers, and we have chosen our own truth. And I hear people when they talk about coming out, quote unquote coming out, they're saying, I'm living my truth now. But we're called to live truth. And who is the perfect truth but Christ? And he shows truthful love on the cross. And you guys, if you look at that, it is bloody, bruised, and beaten. And I think all of us can do a little bit more in showing this love in not a self-interested way, but in a sacrificial, self-mastering way. You know, the church talks about how our entire lives, we're working on overcoming our challenges, overcoming our faults, and turning to God in these moments and offering it up to him, inviting him into our space. Just like at the beginning of the show, I was talking about how millennials are having less sex than ever before. Well, how are we inviting people into our space to have that personal communication, that personal conversation, getting to know each other so that we can get to the point of sharing in the great gift God has offered us in our human sexuality and the potential for this great union, for the good of the spouses, and for the procreation, education of children, having children. It's a beautiful thing that in and of itself is another gift and a self-sacrifice to walk down that journey together. So, you know, I'm looking at these questions, Colleen and Sarah, you've asked all these questions. You know, what about social media is the big one I'm hearing. How do you share about the issue of same-sex attraction and the beauty of what the church teaches to family and friends without them taking the message wrong? I think that we can't reduce it to a social media post. There are some great videos out there that have great long explanations and are short and beautiful. I wouldn't be afraid to share those, but I also wouldn't be afraid to instead take the time to invite that person to dinner. Because I think the example of you in your chaste lifestyle, whether married, right, and your fidelity to your spouse, and even the fact that you have kids around, or maybe your chaste lifestyle of being in a relationship and not living with that person you love and care about and are looking at possibly marrying, that's another example that you're setting. And I think having those opportunities for common ground and not worrying as much about the social media post, I'm not asking you to have dinner every week. Maybe that's what you're called to. Maybe that's what you want to do. but opening your space more often. And don't be afraid to share the social media posts, but always, how would this person view it? How could they view it? Is this what I would want this person to hear if I were saying it? You know, don't be afraid. And I think that a lot of you guys are so sensitive in wanting to properly share the love of God in the church's teaching, even through sharing a video you saw on some great organization's website, that if you really do mean well and you're doing it as an act of love and charity, I don't think there's anything wrong with sharing that. And if they disagree with you, offer the opportunity. I would love to talk to you about this. You know, if they say something, you'll never know. I've had family members who experience same-sex attraction who have actually written and said, oh, you're biased on what you're saying. Okay, well, let's have a conversation about this. And you guys, take the conversation at least out of the public eye sometimes as well. Another question I've seen often is civil unions versus marriage. I know a lot of you are saying, I have a hard time, you know, talking about, well, should they just be able to become civilly united? Civil union and marriage, the important thing is that marriage helps to provide the right of a mother and a father to a child. Marriage is about the regulation of sex and the rights of a child to a mother and a father. And this is why the church will always uphold that marriage is between one man and one woman for the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of the children as that end. And as you hear these other messages out there that can be so confusing, or quotes where someone said Pope Francis made that person gay, the Vatican has never confirmed that that was said. And you guys, I have things that I say that people would love to misquote and throw out there that just aren't true. The church's teaching is true. It is clear. Pick up your Catechism of the Catholic Church and open it up. Go and read Theology of the Body, Love and Responsibility. All of these are excellent and incredible ways to go deeper in your faith, and especially deeper in that understanding of what is marriage and what is sex made for.
This has been Trending with Chris and Timmery. To learn more about Chris Mueller or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak at your upcoming event, visit everydaycatholic.com or timmery.com.